want to welcome everyone. My name is Dawn Rodriguez Ward, and I facilitate this weekly seminar with Jen Baltzegar. And this is brought to you by the Genetic Engineering and Society Center. We're very excited about our virtual speaker this week. But before she begins speaking, I'm going to actually ask for Modesta Abugu to introduce her. And Modesta is one of our Ag Biofuse fellows.
Thanks, Dawn. Hi, everyone. I'm so pleased to introduce to us Dr. Barbara Herhorton. She is a professor emerita and a research professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She's a medical, cultural, and physiological anthropologist with it's over 20 years of research on risk perception and public deliberation on societal and ethical aspects of new technologies, including nanotechnology, fracking, and currently synthetic biology or synthetic cells. Formerly, she served as the founding director of the NSF National Center for and the Nanobiotechnology Society at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She served during 2005 to 2007, where she led international disciplinary teams using mixed social science research methods to study risk and benefit perception regarding new technologies among experts and lay publics in the US and abroad. And since 2019, she's been conducting numerous research on these areas, including the perception of synthetic biology and bottom-up synthetic cells within responsible research and innovation framework. She's had so many publications on this area, and she's been invited to so many places to give expert testimony, including the U.S. Congressional National Nanotechnology Caucus, the Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, the National Academy of Science, the National Nanotechnology Initiative, so many of them, and the list could go on and on. She's also worked for over a decade researching on Latino or farm worker health and risk perceptions in California, and she's currently an elected fellow of the American Anthropological Association and the Society for Applied Anthropology at the AAAS. So everyone, please join me to welcome Dr. Barbara Herhorton.
Thank you, Modesta, so much. That was a lovely introduction. I'm going to share this screen here. Everybody seeing the slides all right?
Great, we could see them.
Okay, so thank you so much. And I'm so happy to be here. And I, as I was saying, I am sorry that I'm not physically present with you, because I would like to be, but my schedule just started getting encroached on in ways that make that schlep not feasible. But anyway, thank you so much. And as I was also saying, I'm just a huge fan of this center and the work that you've all done creating and perpetuating it, and also the significant outreach that you do through it. I'm very envious of it, and am happy to be a part of it for at least for the day. So the work that I'm presenting today is from my team, which is a team of sociology and anthropology grad students at UCSB, and then two main external collaborators, Terry Satterfield and Malin Khandelkar at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And really their intellectual property is part of all of this. And it is a just wonderful collaborative experience. And I think Modesta did such a generous introduction. I don't think I need to belabor this, except to say that the shift to bottom-up cells to focus on bottom-up cells after a fairly extended period working with material science is a big shift for me. And we're still finding ourselves in the logics of biology. So the work that I'm presenting today is funded out of these two initiatives at NSF. So the Understanding the Rules of Life, Building a Synthetic Cell, which convened an ideas lab in 2019, and the Synthetic Neuron and the Proteocell Project were both funded out of collaborations that grew there. I was one of three social science, societal ethics people present in that. So, a lot of work grew out of that. And then the more recent Artificial Coral Project, which was funded last summer, came out of this Designing Synthetic Cells Beyond the Bounds of Evolution, Designer Cells initiative. And this one is a spinoff from, so the lead PI on this, Chris Keating at Penn State, is a chemist who's also one of the co-PIs on the Proteocell Project. And then we have other stuff in the pipeline out of this. So I'm presenting on these three different projects. Well, and I'm not really going to be talking much about artificial coral today, and I'll explain why. But all of these are multi-institutional collaborations with extensive science and engineering collaboration with the people who are developing the synthetic cells. So the synthetic neuron, there are seven PIs of us and seven universities across the country. Proteocell is six different PIs in universities, and then the artificial coral, there are just two of us. But in all of these, I am the only societal social science component. I'm leading the only social science component. And if you could tell from that biography, this is a position that's not unfamiliar to me, as I also in the UC Center for Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology, led the only social science group doing work on the environmental risk perception of engineered nanomaterials. So this has been a part of my life sort of since the nano centers were funded in 2004. And so these three different projects are building different kinds of bottom-up, or attempting to build different kinds of bottom-up synthetic cells, and it allows us to do comparative work across them. So this work began in 2019, and it's ongoing now, although Synneuron and Proteocell are reaching their end of funding life and the end of the work, too. And then, as Modesta mentioned, this work is done within an RRI framework, and I know many of you are at least as familiar as I, if not more so, and mostly did this to bring, so both of those initiatives have an explicit societal ethics component required, and I chose to frame the work that we proposed within the RRI framework because there isn't another framework that is as cohesive, even though this is arguably not that cohesive. There isn't really an alternative in the US that we can use that signals the same kinds of discussions about anticipating participatory engagement and the need for reflection and responsiveness on the part of the innovation system. The work that we're doing is on the public perception side, or that I'm reporting here anyways, on the public perception side, but the work that in these projects is also about engaging with these fairly large collaborations with both the faculty PIs and all their students and postdocs about reflecting on what the public views mean, what the implications are, and what that signals for the future course of the research. And even though we're drawing on this EU model, I would just note that this turn again towards public engagement seems to be happening at the highest levels in the country. So this is a letter from PCAS, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, recommending that the federal agencies incorporate a public engagement core component and that there be a new office to do this. And I have to say, for those of us doing public engagement, public deliberation in the National Nanotech Initiative, we got frequently called into calls with all the lead people from all the 26 federal agencies to tell them how to do public engagement. So this isn't something that we're all that well prepared to do as a country. So the main research questions in my work, and again, this is three different projects, and this is a kind of glossing overview, but nonetheless Sorry, just trying to see if there are any, if anyone sees a chat that I need to see while I'm talking, please tell me, because otherwise it's hard to do this. So first it sounds more descriptive, meaning what are upstream perceptions of bottom-up synthetic cells? And that sounds fairly transparent, even what one of my nano science collaborators called doing the metrology of the public. We're not really doing the metrology of the public, but even this, the upstreamness means there's very low awareness, and it's not a matter of simply asking people what they think, because they have no idea. They don't know what this is, and they don't necessarily know what they think. And so the research on this, as many of you know, is challenging. And it's not a straightforward data extraction. Not that most of us in my research world would not think it's ever that straightforward in any case. And so then we're also interested in how these perceptions differ by what, and again, this is reflecting my risk perception background, not so much my anthropology background. So we think about the characteristics of the technologies themselves, different applications, different benefits, different risks, potentials for misuse. And increasingly, we're seeing a lot on bodily environmental interactions as critical in this. We're also interested in how they differ by the characteristics of the perceivers. So by their social location, all that socio-demographic stuff, and including personal experiences of exposures, views on science and technology, their values, their views on environmental justice, views on their situation in the world, and their views on other technologies. And then we also are taking account of the societal contextual factors that are important in the production of these views. So the innovation system in the US, since this is a US-based study, and how it works and how it affects people. COVID-19 was a huge impact in this work. Accelerating inequality in the nation is also very evident in the data, and also just this moment in time and what that means to people. We're interested as well in how different or similar they are to other technological risk perception and what the implications of that are. So there isn't other work on synthetic cells, the exact thing that we're studying, but there is obviously quite a lot on SynBio. There's a lot more on biotech and nanotech that we contributed to, and also on new technologies more broadly. And then what the implications of that might be. Usually the implications are that views are very specific, and the government and industry and science and engineering cannot assume that public views are going to trend in any particular expected direction. And then we see a lot in this realm, maybe more than in some other realms. There's been a huge amount written about all the ethical challenges of gene editing and how all the impacts on publics, and without actually having any discussions with publics about their concerns, and nor with actually having much evidence about what those views are. And so we're also asking how what we're finding aligns with the many statements that have been made by experts about what public concerns are or should or might be. And then there are policy and governance implications. And just to be clear, obviously in this relatively brief presentation, I can't present all of our data on that. And I'll show you how I've chosen to wend my way through it for this. But then obviously we're very interested in hearing more of your thoughts about all of this. This work is in preparation. We're resubmitting one piece right now. We are really in producing the publications out of this right now. And so the methodological approach, again, as Modesta indicated, I'm a mixed methods researcher. So, and we've used these in our past research. The mixed methods means pretty much the full range from anthropological, ethnographic work to so highly inductive to straight quantitative survey research and everything in between. And so the aim here was to get nuanced understanding of what we see as emergent upstream US public views. And the qualitative work has included public and expert interviews. So the public interviews, and I'm not going to do a lot of presentation on methods here, but again, happy to answer questions on that. So the main public was a COVID pivot. We had proposed to do public deliberations, following up on our public deliberations on nano and on fracking, and we just couldn't because of COVID restrictions on face-to-face work. So we shifted to online interviews with a very carefully constructed sample that Qualtrics recruited for us in a major U.S. City. And then expert interviews, we've done two full rounds of expert interviews with collaborators in our collaborations. And then the quantitative work is based on a national survey that Qualtrics, again, recruited for us, on an online survey that was constructed to be relatively more dialogic, meaning engaged in a dialogue rather than data extraction per se. And then the Artificial Coral Project that was just funded last summer is to do the public deliberations that we couldn't do at the beginning, now focused on artificial coral and climate change. And those are in preparation right now. So I'm not going to really present on them, but I'm happy to answer questions about them. Okay, so I'm going to summarize the main findings and then give you three more detailed accounts, because that's kind of all I can do in this time. So first of all, we're definitely see lots of evidence of US-based techno-optimism in our results. The publics in both the qualitative and the quantitative work. So there's high acceptance of the idea. So we asked people about whether understanding the rules of life was a sufficient reason to do this work, to fund this research. And the answer is a pretty resoundingly yes. And particularly, people articulated that understanding more about biology was particularly important. Again, we wouldn't have known that or expected that exactly. There is an assumption about economic benefits. And job creation that will ensue, and in general, health and medical applications are seen as useful and beneficial. But we also see a raft of downsides and concerns with this. So safety and biosafety risks and uncertainty, which I have to say in this domain, the experts are relatively unconcerned about, and publics are highly uncertain about. There is concern about accelerating inequality, about corporate profiteering that they see as likely to result from this kind of innovation. Although some people are enthusiastic and positive about job creation, others are very confident that this kind of development will lead to job loss, that tech development in general produces job loss, not job creation, especially for them, and lack of affordability and access, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. A lot of concerns about embodiment, more than we've seen before, way more than we saw with nano. Concern about unknown long-term effects, where the line should be drawn regarding human enhancement. So we were talking about synthetic neuron and a neuronal system. A neuronal system is, you know, a brain. And we did gauge across a sort of a degree of syntheticness to see where people's lines of acceptability are, and they definitely, human enhancement is still a huge red flag. Concern about environmental harms, concern about interfering with nature on several levels, and also a strong need for reform in governance, which I'm going to talk about briefly. So overall, I just don't think acceptability, which is something, as you know, many in government talk about and are concerned about whether there will be acceptability. There's sort of high acceptability and high risk perception. And so this absolutely is what we would call ambivalence, with high risk and high benefit perception. And so I thought in this time that what I would do is trace through three examples out of our data. One on this idea of acceptability versus ambivalence by looking at views on affordability and access to the products of this work. The second on the position of endorsement yet need for reform on views on the innovation system, and then share with you a little much more exploratory on how we've gone about exploring people's ideas about the boundaries between living and non-living, because that issue, again, has been the presumptive issue that many have assumed will be critical, but we haven't seen a lot of open-ended research on what that actually means, what people in the U.S. and elsewhere actually think about what those boundaries are or should be, and so we've taken a stab in that direction. So the first example on affordability and access. So basic research is often framed as contributing to broader social good. And fundamentally, this research is actually driven, the RRI framework is actually asking about how the public good is being supported by it and how the public views the potential for public good out of it. That's really our fundamental aim here. But accessibility and affordability of new technologies complicate and, in our view, limit the scope of the benefits. And so we did ask whether public's concerns about the affordability limit their perceived benefits in this case. And so the critical context in the U.S. is that medicines are unquestionably seen as important new innovations. There's widespread agreement about that. But healthcare in the U.S. is very expensive, and its high cost contributes to health inequalities. It's mostly private for-profit system, and public distrust of the pharmaceutical industry undergirds a lot of their response in this. They see the pharmaceutical industry as greedy and profiteering and limiting any public benefit out of this. And so these broader social contexts, we would argue, are very important for understanding there. You can't just ask about the views of the technology. And so the methods here, again, this is quick snapshot of the methods. So we developed and pretested about 20 times an interview protocol that came out of the deliberative protocol we had been developing before COVID shut things down. And so it proceeds that way. It assumes that people don't necessarily start with any knowledge about this sphere. We want to know about them and how they see themselves in society. We want to know their views on science and technology. We want to give them the information they need to actually have a conversation with us about something as inchoate and esoteric as a synthetic neuron, which has some intuitive understanding, and a proteocell, which may not have any intuitive understanding. And so we do provision of knowledge. We carefully vetted those definitions. We made sure that they were accessible and understandable with no additional scientific knowledge, which is very challenging to do. But is essential to ensure equity in the context. This is a big deal in deliberation, but we think it's important in survey as well. And we paid close attention to framing effects. We then concluded with broader questions about science and technology development, including views on the innovation system. And so we did do a very carefully recruited sample for this. It's a quasi-representative sample in terms of political party preference and gender and all those other variables up there. And so this is just to give you an example of what the definition, what the definitions look like in this. So, and so I don't know that I read this to you. I'll let you, you can read this. But essentially, we have to define what a neuron is, and actually we have to define what a cell is too. And I have slides on that if you want me to pull them up, but I haven't kept them in this stack. And so a synthetic neuron is a type of synthetic cell that could, in theory, mimic the shape and function of real neurons. If built from the bottom up as a cell-like entity, a synthetic neuron could master the chemical and electrical communication just mentioned. So it's very focused on the synapse and how to engineer the synapse. And they hope that a neuronal system could eventually have medical applications, although if you talk to my collaborators, they will hasten to tell you they're nowhere near this level of development, but they have made significant progress. And so out of the qualitative work, and this is this first example is all based on these interviews, we asked them first, what are your first impressions of synthetic neurons? And this, we look for this kind of intuitive response, which is often affectively driven in a condition of low awareness. So we say, Joy says, my gut tells me it would be a good idea. I can see lots of medical uses for it. And Dustin says, that to me is hugely beneficial, really, you know, cool technology that probably would save some people who are paralyzed. So they do see medical benefits, and that was basically all of the respondents saw medical benefits as a good thing, especially at the lowest end of that scale of alteration, meaning to repair an injured spinal cord. And at the same time, all of them. So we don't see unanimous responses like this in a lot of research, but all 40 of these interviewees thought that synthetic neurons would be unaffordable. And they were also skeptical that the development would be handled fairly, safely, and transparently. Apparently. So in response to the how affordable do you think the synthetic neuron will likely be, Jesse says, I assume they'll be expensive at first and then get cheaper over time. So that kind of trickle-down logic is one we saw a lot in nano work as well. But then the others are saying, I don't think that would be able to afford anything remotely close to all of that. My screen is partly occluded by people. And then how affordable, I can't imagine it's going to be affordable, not affordable for the average Joe. And that's extreme. So again, that was ubiquitous, that response. And then the final twist on that is that not only do they think it is highly beneficial, not affordable, but they think it should be affordable. And so how affordable do you think it will be? I think it should be made really affordable so that everybody who really desires it for the right reason could get it. I'd probably say they should be affordable. If it's funded with public money, it should be affordable for the public. If they're using the public to fund, they should make it very affordable to the public. So very, very strong ethical principles of ethical and equity articulated in these. And so overall, acceptability is complicated and contingent. And I'm not showing you all the other sort of constraints on benefit that arose in these depth interviews, but people see many benefits. They're enthusiastic, especially about the use for treating injured people, but lack of affordability and access create distributive justice issues for many respondents. And then some also question the ethical issues of research funding funded with public funds not being accessible to the public. Although I will say that some are also quite accepting of that as the American way, that things start out funded with public funding and then they go into industry. And at that point, they are private, but eventually the public will benefit. That is a common understanding, although with more discussion, that becomes more problematic to people. And then the other main perceived risks are social, ethical, that use for human enhancement is a red line issue, that inequitable, there's a strong fear of inequitable access to advantageous technologies accelerating inequalities that are already excessive. that jobs created will be specialized, not for me, that loss of jobs as a possible effect of tech development is something they seem pretty clear about. So the second example I wanted to give is out of, is more showing again the complexity of enthusiasm combined with need, perceived need for reform of the US innovation system. So in this case, we defined the innovation system saying you can think of the innovation system as the system of people, regulations, and organizations such as universities, industries, and the government that combine their efforts to develop and promote new technologies such as synthetic cells. And we did vet this definition extensively. It was to try to come up with one that was broad enough to be understandable to people, but also acceptable to the experts we were working with. And so does the public view of the innovation system, view the innovation system as contributing to the public good, and how does this correlate with the acceptability of bottom-up cells? So for this, we generated an 8-item question set. We couldn't find one that actually has been done studying perceptions of the innovation system itself. There's quite a bit on attitudes about science and technology, but that is not really the same thing, we would argue. It's a reasonable question whether people have any knowledge of the innovation system to bring to judgment of this kind, and which is why we did definition provision. I don't think I'll read all these to you, but I can show you here. So here are these statements in summary and showing from fairly lukewarm agreement at the bottom here with the blue, and those are showing the confidence intervals, that the U.S. innovation system takes public input and concerns into account, which is a pretty core premise of RRI. And on up to the bracketed ones, which show the strongest agreement, are what we are calling reform variables, where drugs developed with taxpayer funds should be affordable, and that we should enact better regulations to ensure safe development of new technology. And the ones with red, we are describing as critique, meaning that the US mainly benefits large corporations, pharma and biotech, and that the US innovation system causes too much environmental harm. And then the blue ones we see as support, but it is not as robust as the agreement with the need for reform. And you can see this here, where this is the results of a principal components analysis, which is the way we risk perception researchers tend to do our research. And so the reform variable is all of these, this loads into three components. The Kronbach alpha is very high. These are, two-item components in PCAs is, something we could have an argument about. But in any case, there is a complex of views about the innovation system and about whom it's for and how it benefits people. And I'm not showing those data here, but the reform, we've been very interested in the don't know responses, because in the conditions of low awareness like this, this was true in our nanotech work too, don't knows, we normally throw don't know data out, but don't knows are actually highly diagnostic. And the reform variables were the ones with the highest knowledge base, meaning minimal don't know responses. And the other ones, especially things like the US innovation system causes too much environmental harm, had a very high don't know response to it. And so in doing the analysis of this, we focused on reform variables with regression analyses that I'm not going to present here, but I have some of that data in slides if you want to ask questions about it. So we see pretty solid support for the intrinsic ideas of RRI in this. We actually found people variable across the variables in terms of their ability to form judgments about the innovation system itself, which might be a pretty elusive and opaque concept to a lot of people. That we found what we think is relatively high perceived desire for reform of the innovation system, and the idea that without reform, the innovation system would cause harm, and greater acceptability of bottom-up synthetic cells also correlates strongly with higher support for the innovation system, which is maybe intuitively understandable, but it's not there in the literature in any way we can find. So we see the public as viewing the innovation system as contributing to the public good, but that also the need for reform is widely supported there. And then this last case I want to take you through, this is exploratory findings on the boundaries between living and non-living. And so here we're asking, will new synthetic artificial forms be seen as living or non-living? And how do we know? And what are the perceived characteristics of life? So this is highly inductive, so much more out of my anthropological approach to not making assumptions about how people see things or what people know, and asking in as diverse a way as possible. And so here this is where the mixed methods of starting with qualitative data and qualitative interviews and then moving to quantitative work, it makes very, very good sense. And so we did ask in the public interviews whether something can be both alive and not alive. We asked, what does it mean for something to be alive? We're also interested in whether you think the same entity can be both living and non-living. Can you think of ways you can tell if something is living or non-living? And we got these responses that say, no, something cannot be living and non-living. Frank says, boy, I don't know. I can't imagine that it can. That's a deep question. People are not used to having these conversations in the US, definitely. And Martin says, oh boy, living and non-living. No, not within my definition, no. Diana says, I couldn't fathom it. Lisa says, no, I mean, living is living and non-living is non-living. So I would say no. But some said, yes, things could be both alive and not alive. And they offered examples of things that they thought are both living and non-living from the natural world, like viruses, hermit crabs, and coral, which we're studying in this new work. And Adam described humans as having living and non-living parts with hair and fingernails, and they're dead. So yes, both. And then Robert in this says, I guess, again, to go back to the example of like a robot, right? So I think a robot could be biologically not alive. It doesn't need to eat. It doesn't breathe. It doesn't have biological cells, and it could have a sentience that enables it to experience emotion and to react and act on an emotional level. So I think in that case, like something could be alive, but not biologically alive. Sure. I think this quote is really good for getting at what we're trying to do in this work, which is to open up and see how diverse and unfixed and mobile the views about what living constitutes is. And so we then took those interview data and we made this a survey. In the survey, we created this item list of 30 items that includes hermit crab, coral, and virus, just to show you how things flow from the interviews into this, and includes a whole lot of other things. And I probably can't defend for you why everything that's here was here. This is completely exploratory. And we asked whether for each thing, whether it's alive, both alive and not alive, not alive, or don't know. And so this is, again, survey findings. And we find these fascinating, and I'd love to hear from you all what you think of this and what you think it might mean. We're pushing out other main publications right now, and this is much more exploratory. But so these are sorted by the proportion alive. So the green is alive, the gray is both, and the orange is not alive. And we noticed we loved that dogs were more alive than human on this scale. And I also particularly like that Siri down here at the bottom is that 15% of respondents think that Siri is alive or both not alive and living. And so we can have lots of discussions about what this means. We can't really tell you what this means, but this is what we are going to be doing in the artificial coral public deliberations, is a much more depth exploration of what it means, of what these boundaries mean, and whether there are boundaries or whether there are much more fluid kinds of understandings. Sorry. And the other thing we did was we took these data and to get at sort of the measure of ambiguity reflected in them, we sorted them by both. So the gray, remember, is things that are both alive and not alive. And sorted this way, you can first of all see that the synthetic cells are right at the top here. So in this ambiguous state, only below coma. Again, humans and dogs at the bottom with the least ambiguity. But I'd love if we had time to have a focused discussion about what you think this might mean. But I want to go on. And we've done a PCA on this. I think this, first of all, 30 items is really too many for PCA, but it is interesting to think about what the values connecting sunlight, fire, wind, river, water, soil, the earth, and coma, which is the one negative correlation there. We can come back to that if you want. And so then, in addition to thinking about boundaries between living and non-living, we wanted to think about what the characteristics of living are seen to be. And you can see that some of the previous quotes that I made actually express people's criteria for living. These are out of our expert interviews where experts said it should be able to reproduce, it should be able to breathe, acting very autonomously and self-replicating. And then this last quote is talking about whether the organism can feel pain. And so we also came up with this index of 15 items we asked people to judge whether it was an essential characteristic of life or not an essential characteristic of life, or don't know. And we included, obviously the experts' judgments about breathing, feeling, and reproducing are on there, but also other things like having a spirit or a soul, having consciousness, converting energy from one form to another, ability to die. The blue is the percentage. So 90% of respondents in this national sample said that ability to eat was an essential characteristic of life. And somewhat surprisingly, I think, only 80% say that ability to reproduce is an essential characteristic of life, and only 73% say that movement is an essential characteristic of life. And we were, in the interviewing part of this, not this survey part, we were sort of asking, you encounter an entity of some kind, how do you form a judgment about whether it's alive or not? These are mostly drawn from there. And so there is discriminativeness here, and I can't yet tell you what it means, but I thought you might find it interesting. I find this stuff fascinating, and I cannot find any, we haven't been able to find other research that is doing this in this way, in a really bottom-up social science, where we're just asking in the simplest way what this means. So what does this all mean? And I'm drawing to the end of my time here, if you're getting nervous. US So we see that U.S. public perceptions are actually deeply ambivalent. And I've tried to show this, that they're complex. They are seeing lots of potential benefits, but they're woven in with concerns about risks, notably inequitable distribution, but there are lots of other concerns as well. The concerns are not necessarily intrinsic at all to the technology, which is one of the useful things about having multiple cases we can compare across. So the applications are really important. There this issue of lack of trust or an excess of trust. So we found both the experts and the publics in this research extremely blasé in general about regulation, even though the survey is showing need for reform as a important effect. But in general, there is an assumption that whatever is needed is in place and will be needed. Again, very different from Nano, which was pushing on the boundaries of the regulatory system in a different and more overt way. And yet there is a strong desire for assurance about a safe development, and that they definitely don't think that is in place. So it's a complex, it's not a simple thing. These views are not monolithic, and nor are they highly polarized, so by political ideology or religiosity, as others have shown with SynBio. And we don't see a stable idea of life or its boundaries, so there's a lot more work to be done. And I guess final shot, I would say upstream views are contingent. We know this from the literature and from all the work we've done, so they may not be stable. And especially if there are big risk events, we would expect them to change. We've been working within RRI by working with these collaborative groups on trying to bring public views and concerns back for reflection and considered response. But there is no model for how to do this in the U.S., and it's not part of our vernacular. So I think that's where we all really need to be working. And some of you, like certainly Jennifer Kuzma, has done a lot of work in this area already, and we look to learn from you as we go. So that's it, and I'm done, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Barbara. We have several questions in the chat in just about 10 minutes before the end of the hour. So hopefully we can get to most of them.
Jill? Oh, I am sorry. My timer is showing something different, but okay.
Yeah, it's okay. So Jill, it usually works best if I just read the questions in the chat to you.
Should I stop the screen?
Yeah, sharing? That would probably be good. Okay. We'll spotlight you. So Jill Ferguson asks, thank you for your incredibly clear and well-organized presentation. You cited the PCAS calls for public engagement, and we, as a group of scholars, seem to consider interviews such as those conducted by your team as a form of engagement potentially tied to addressing ethical and social implications. I am curious if the interview responses or subsequent analyses shed light on perceptions of public engagement itself and the types of engagement needed to deepen understanding of social and ethical issues. Perhaps your finding need for reform governance applies to this question.
Yeah. Great question. We haven't so much. So in the public deliberation, we will absolutely ask about that. Our experience with Nano deliberations is you do a day-long deliberation, people being just utterly brilliant and thoughtful and in so many ways. And you get to the end of the day and you say, so do you think the public should be more involved in decision making through these kinds of deliberations? And they go, oh no, the public doesn't know enough. And then we would just tear our hair out. You just did it for 8 hours. I think again, and I guess against the backdrop of our multiple comparative US-UK, the UK with our collaborator Nick Pidgeon at Cardiff University, the UK is just such a different world for doing this. We just don't have the vernacular here. People are not, the protocol for our Nano deliberation started off saying, today is a deliberative day. And you do that in the UK and they all nod and sit up and they know exactly, okay, we're going to talk about responsible government. And you do that in the US and they look at you and go, huh, what the heck is that? We do not. We have so much work to be done to figure out. We do see these kinds of interviews as engagement, but we're also very ambivalent ourselves about, you know, selecting ourselves to be the interlocutors for the public. That is just not the right way to do it as a governmental practice. It's a step in the right direction, and that's how we see it.
Okay, great. The next question is from Kristen Landreville, and she asks, regarding the living versus non-living, I'm curious how Indigenous perspectives would approach that question. There's opportunity to explore the differences in Indigenous versus Western thought on this question of living versus non-living. And related, Nandina Mindu says, what about plants and fungi in your surveys? Would they be included in the definition of living or non-living? So a little different with the Indigenous Western question, but yeah. I wanted to put those together.
Yeah. So we are working on bringing, so the deliberations we're doing as part of the Artificial Coral Project, we are trying to work with local Indigenous communities. And so those are brilliant questions. And, you know, they're just alluded to in these very open-ended work we've done so far, but we would like to do a lot more on that. And the plants and fungi question, we would be asking how people view them. We wouldn't be, again, so we would definitely be deliberating on that. I mean, and the coral case itself in the artificial coral is so interesting because it's such a hybrid, you know, it's a hybrid animal, plant and inanimate, you know, calcifications. It's itself a really interesting, evocative item for having those kinds of discussions.
Okay. Our next question is from Carter Clinton, and he says, as someone who works with the non-living, as in humans, I constantly think about this question, like a rock soil has a life cycle, but is it alive? Or is the better question, is it ever really dead? When someone gets the answer, let me know.
Yeah, so we would love to have suggest. We're designing deliberation now, and this is the living, non-living, and the characteristics of life. And also, I didn't talk about, but we have quite a bit of material on views about evolution and you know, improving on evolution, and so we'd love to have suggestions about better ways to approach those in a deliberative setting, how to have those conversations in the most open and inclusive way. We'd love suggestions from anybody who has them.
Okay, we have about 5 more minutes. I'm going to read one more question from the chat, but if anyone wants to use the raise your hand function, feel free to do that and I can call on you. Also, if you feel comfortable, we'll turn on your video so Barbara doesn't feel alone answering her questions to the void. Okay, so Katie Sanders says, would you be able to briefly describe the methodological difference between a survey developed from a dialogue perspective rather than data extraction?
Yeah, so, you know, that's partly a matter of intent, and it's also partly, so a dialogic perspective, and, you know, the most extreme form of that might be what my colleague Terry Satterfield has done, which is called a pathway survey. They have a out of our nano work, they have a pathway survey they published in PNAS you might want to look at, but where it's the idea is the understanding that it's a conversation and it builds and the participant is gaining knowledge and making sense of what you're really after in ways that are not necessarily in the questions themselves. And so it's partly paying close attention to primacy effects and the staging of understanding, but it's also trying to open things up to understand the decisions people are making in their responses.
Okay, and our next question is from Fred Gould, and he says, just curious about how much of the variation do your first three principal components typically explain?
The PCA in the innovation system, I think it's explaining like 78% or something of the variance. It's a lot. If that is the question.
I think that's the question.
Yeah. Our standard, it's a very solid PCA response. Yeah.
Yes. I'd like to get results like that.
I know. We're happy to have those results.
Jennifer, would you like to lower your hand and ask your question?
Yeah, Barbara, thanks for the great talk. So at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned how you're like the only, SCI group that's engaged in this SynCell project. And we're kind of playing a similar role for this new Center on Precision Microbiome Engineering, and we're doing some public perception studies. How are you planning on feeding that back to the research team? And how do you think they're going to incorporate it into their work? Because we're striving to do the same thing, taking an RRI approach and, trying to feed back some of this to the research team. So how is that occurring? How well is it occurring? What are some of the challenges with that?
Yeah, I'm hoping that I will write some about this. So we've had the most wonderful collaborators. They honestly, maybe because this grew out of an ideas lab where we were all thrown together for a week. But maybe also just they're really interested and well-disposed, but it's totally outside their wheelhouse. And so it's a bit structured in that we've had monthly project team meetings on both those projects since inception. And we were supposed to have annual face-to-face meetings, but COVID killed that. And in those, all the teams present research. So we are presenting our research to them. And I've been training my grads this is part of this process. We are really working hard to have that serve as a form of engagement. And they've been extremely open to it. They've given us more time. They're really interested in telling us what they think about all this. But it's not formalized. And we actually, we had proposed to do some more work that would be more directly expert public engagement, and NSF in its infinite wisdom chose not to fund that. But that's really where this needs to go. It shouldn't be us putting ourselves in the middle of that. It should be, I'd be happy to facilitate it, but it really, when you're in a room, when a deliberative session with publics, it's pretty mind-blowing just how the sort of social intelligence of publics and experiencing that is a really a mind-blowing thing for a lot of people. And I think that would be the way to do that. But it's also expensive and extremely laborious to do it well. And I'm so sorry I'm not there to talk more about the project. So we should make a time to meet and talk about it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. If everyone, we're done with the hour. So if everyone could help me thank Barbara for a good talk, and I want to thank everyone for their good questions. And I would like to remind you that next week is our last seminar of the semester, and it's going to be in person only. There will not be a Zoom option. It will be our Ag BioFuse students giving us an update on their most recent research. And so come in person and support our students, and we will see you next week. And again, thank you, Barbara, for a very informative
talk. Thanks so much for having me. Really a pleasure.
It was great. Thank you.